on top of Christopher Wren's Greenwich Hospital. Prokofiev, for his part, wrote a pastiche symphony in the style of Haydn, known as The Classical, and had his own stab at clownish knockabout in the ballet Chute, The Tale of the Buffoon, also for the Ballet Russe. Though Diaghilev and Prokofiev first put it together in 1915, it was not deemed ready for production until 1921, and even then, amid post-war euphoria and forgetfulness, Chute's black comedy of serial wife-murdering was lost on the audience. Francis Poulenc's Ballet Russe commission, Les Biches, 1924, also plundered the old curiosity shop of dance styles, mixing and matching with more recent fashions and unashamedly giving movements names like rag mazurka. There's something laudable in the attempts of these sophisticated, well-heeled composers and their fellow Ballet Russe artists to capture the popularity of Keystone Cop-style entertainment of the time, but also something rather desperate and even embarrassing about the results. It was rather like someone's dad turning up at the school disco and jiving awkwardly with the kids. Comparing Chute with Chaplin's The Kid of the same year sheds a cruel and amateurish light on the former. Chaplin went on to make, and compose music for, a series of truly outstanding full-length films: The Gold Rush, 1925, City Lights, 1931, Modern Times, 1936, and The Great Dictator, 1940, all of them notable for being knockabout fun with consummate physical skill, contemporary resonance, social insight, and considerable emotional power. Most important, and this is often conveniently glossed over, they were popular throughout the world because they were actually good. It was no coincidence that an urge to disinter elements from music's past should have come about at a time when, invigorated in large part due to recording technology, scholarly interest in earlier music was enjoying a new lease of life. French composer-academic Vincent Dandy, tutor of Cole Porter, amongst others, put on a performance in Paris in February 1913 of Monteverdi's opera The Coronation of Poppea, using an edition of the score he had painstakingly reconstructed from surviving but neglected manuscripts. The opera hadn't been heard in its entirety in public since 1651. Monteverdi's earlier 1607 opera, L'Orfeo, was produced on stage at Oxford University in 1925 for the first time since its composer's death nearly 300 years earlier. In 1926, in a monastery in Piedmont, northwest Italy, a huge treasure trove of Vivaldi manuscripts thought lost in the Napoleonic Wars was rediscovered, including the scores of 300 concertos, 19 operas, and over 100 other works. This haul was in effect the start of the 20th century's Vivaldi revival and a great flowering of musicological interest in this hitherto all but forgotten master. Though Stravinsky had been and continued to be one of the standard-bearers of the new-from-old trend in such works as his magnificent Symphony of Psalms, 1930, and his Hogarth-inspired opera, The Rake's Progress, 1951, he was instrumental in breaking away from its strictures too. Having detonated a modernist explosion with his Rite of Spring in 1913, his name subsequently becoming a byword throughout the world for the edgy contemporary classical composer, he was not yet ready to retire from the front line. As is so often the case in music's rich history, the most original, daring and influential works, Beethoven's Eroica Symphony, Richard Strauss's Salome, are ones that creep up on the world, apparently out of nowhere. Stravinsky's complicated 1923 masterpiece Svarebka, known mostly by its French title Les Noces, The Wedding, is another such smoking gun. The basic premise of the work, which was first conceived 10 years earlier in the aftermath of Diaghilev and Stravinsky's The Rite of Spring, is the recreation of an Orthodox Russian peasant wedding ritual using spoken and sung fragments of speech. Stravinsky, who had by 1923 emigrated from his homeland, later reflected on the bride's loss of virginity being to some extent a metaphor for what he saw as the 1917 revolution's rape of Mother Russia. At any rate, there was a brutal vigour and anonymity to the conjugal proceedings in the piece. At times, the role of the voice is akin to the modern technique of rapping. The hybrid, keening, singing, declaiming style Stravinsky adopted was like no sound ever before heard in a concert hall or theatre. It's an extraordinary noise, even to tired, over-bombarded modern ears. The use of voices, chorus and soloists, as quasi-instrumental sound effect texture was revolutionary enough in itself, but the nature of the rest of the ensemble is equally startling. A large battery of percussion instruments, including four pianos. Stravinsky had at various points in the genesis of the work toyed with the inclusion of synchronised pianolas, mechanical roll-operated pianos, harmoniums, and keyboard-controlled cymbaloms, a hammered string folk instrument prevalent in Eastern Europe and Russia. The resulting jangling, sparklingly dissonant sound, which is brittle, full of edgy attack and a kind of out-of-tune resonance, would have been, literally, unimaginable, even terrifying to audiences of the day. One contemporary critic described Les Noces as enough to convert intending brides and bridegrooms to celibacy. To other composers, though, as they gradually came across Les Noces, its peculiar, faux-primitive, fierce sound proved irresistible. To them, its assault on the senses was startlingly fresh, as if someone had uninvented the symphony orchestra and started again from scratch. The sound world of Les Noces is, quite simply, the most imitated of all 20th century combinations outside the fields of jazz and popular music. The auditory sensation of the piece is faithfully imitated, to a greater or lesser degree, in works as different from each other as Karloff's Carmina Burana, 1937, Béla Bartók's Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion, also 1937, Olivier Messiaen's Turangalila Symphony, 1948, Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, 1957, Steve Reich's Music for Mallet Instruments, Voices and Organ, 1973, John Adams's Grand Pianola Music, 1982, James McMillan's Veni, Veni, Emmanuel, 1992, and a gallimaufry of film scores, of which Bernard Herrmann's for 1963's Jason and the Argonauts, particularly the coming alive of the Skeleton Army, and Hans Zimmer's Angels and Demons, 2009, the least believable film ever made, are but two randomly plucked examples. In all of the above, it is the metallic, kitchen utensil-like sense of attack and attrition of the percussion, combined with the high-frequency, bell-like penetration of the tuned instruments, that so effectively assaults and enchants the listener. The impact of this orchestrational colour is literally and historically inescapable. While Stravinsky's notoriety as classical music's Lord of Misrule afforded him the kind of profile that encouraged wealthy philanthropists to be generous in their support of him, especially after his move to America in 1939, in many ways he was an anomaly. For classical music as a whole, the 1920s were marked by deep fissures in the previously unchallenged prestige of Western art music. The writing was certainly on the wall. The unveiling in 1926 of a new opera by the last great Italian composer in the genre, Giacomo Puccini, could fairly be described as a media event on a global scale. Turandot was performed to huge audiences from Milan to Buenos Aires in short succession. Its biggest tune, Nessun Dorma, was incredibly popular, not just with a few die-hard fans, but rather with just about everyone who heard it. It became an instant classic. But Turandot was to be a last hurrah. With the exception of a handful of later works by American composers John Adams and Philip Glass, newly written operas gradually became more or less invisible to the population at large, even as the audience for revivals of old operas grew and grew. A newly composed classical opera in the late 20th century was like beluga caviar, a shockingly expensive commodity from an endangered species, accessible to a very privileged few, but an inconceivable luxury to the rest. The knee-jerk reaction of many classical music commentators to this flight from opera is to find causes in changing social habits, in education, in broadcasting priorities, and the grip of the marketplace. But this conceals one important reality. Composers themselves were drifting towards alternatives to long-established musical forms and traditions. Audiences may well have flocked to new, younger Puccinis had they come along, but composers didn't want to be new Puccinis anymore. A bracing example of how the landscape was changing can be seen in the unfolding career of the classically trained son of an Orthodox Jewish cantor, Kurt Weill. Weill's early exposure to music would have been envied by many classical composers. His parents actively encouraged interest and funded formal studies in music, and he received training both at his local opera house in Dessau and at music academies in Berlin. His early compositions place him squarely in the post-Mahler European classical tradition. A skillfully constructed First Symphony of 1921 and his first full-length opera, Der Protagonist, showing him to be not so very different from his contemporaries, Samuel Barber in the USA, Shostakovich in Russia, Arthur Bliss in the UK, or Paul Hindemith in Germany. Then he made a stylistic leap that dramatically transformed his career and the course of music history with it. As Germany's vulnerable but well-meaning Weimar Republic of the 1920s and early 30s grappled with hyperinflation, unpayable war reparations, rioting and the rise of extremism to left and right, a remarkable cultural scene emerged in Berlin. It was, to some extent, the European equivalent of what Gershwin was doing in America, finding a hybrid style that existed in the no-man's land between jazz and classical, a no-man's land that was ultimately to become everyman's land, though its protagonists didn't know it at the time. Unlike the frivolous goings-on in Paris or New York, though, the cabaret style of Weimar Berlin had a deadly serious undertow. In the cultural soup that was Weimar Germany, Kurt Weill teamed up with communist playwright Bertolt Brecht in the making of a piece of musical theatre that was neither strictly speaking an opera, a play with songs, nor a musical, though it contained elements of all of these. Its vocal ranges were operatic, its naturalistic acting style more like that of a play, its structure of spoken, plot-carrying scenes interspersed with verse-chorus-designed songs akin to those in musicals. The Threepenny Opera was the Berlin stage hit of 1928. The Threepenny Opera wasn't intended just as escapist fun in hard times, but also as a piece of biting Marxist satire critiquing the corruption of capitalism. It was based on John Gay's 18th-century mock opera, The Beggar's Opera, which had, in 1920, been revived to great acclaim at the Lyric Theatre in Hammersmith, a production known to Brecht, Weill, and their translator, Elizabeth Hauptmann. Its musical texture deliberately mined the sleazy Berlin cabaret style of the moment, as it did popular dance idioms like the foxtrot and tango. But it was written with a knowing wink towards operetta and sentimental romanticism, especially in Weill's setting of words of hard-hearted irony. MacHeath, Mac the Knife, and prostitute Jenny, for example, share a genteel duet, the tango-spirited Zuhälter Ballade, about their previous times together, he the abusive pimp, she the put-upon sex worker who, while going along with the mock nostalgia of the song, betrays him to the police. The most memorable song of the show, the Ballad of Mac the Knife, acts as a prelude to the unfolding fable, a laconic but immediately catchy melody that, were it not for the lyrics, could be mistaken for a Berlin tea dance song, with a piano accompaniment that becomes increasingly like something from a 1920s Shanghai opium den. The lyrics, by deliberate, sharp contrast, speak graphically of Mackie Messer's appalling catalogue of crimes. In Depression-era Europe, the Threepenny Opera clearly struck a chord. By the time Weill left Germany for the USA in 1933, it had been translated into 18 languages and performed several thousand times. It was one of three collaborations Weill put together with Brecht, alongside Happy End and The Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni, a triptych whose tone is a world away from the wacky tomfoolery of Sati's Parade and Prokofiev's Shoot of the previous decade. All three Brecht-Weill pieces address the social inequalities of the day head-on, in a deliberately non-arty, low-budget way. The Threepenny Opera was a kind of train-spotting for the late 1920s, presenting the middle classes with a grimy, warts-and-all vision of the alienated, nihilistic underclass. some measure of the political sensitivity and topicality of the Brecht-Weyl musicals is apparent when compared with Stravinsky's notoriously controversial Rite of Spring. While the latter had had a few people in black tie and tails heckling its first performance in 1913 in Paris, the rise and fall of the City of Mahagoni's first night in Leipzig in 1930 was invaded by brown-shirted Nazi thugs who intimidated audiences so much that the show was pulled after a few days. At a time when the inventor of serialism, Arnold Schoenberg, was pompously describing his music as produced on German soil without foreign influences and therefore able most effectively to oppose Latin and Slav hopes of hegemony, Weyl was deliberately mixing and matching a range of styles and trends that were around in the 1920s and 30s. He added little touches of whatever took his fancy, from a chorus that sounded like a German Lutheran hymn, Schlusschoral, to a quick-stepping Dixieland rag, Ballade von angenehmen Leben, the Ballad of Good Living. Musically speaking, the Threepenny Opera would have sounded to people of the time like a distorted jukebox of contemporary sounds, filtered by the razor-sharp mind of a man who had already composed an opera and a symphony. It was nevertheless a style that found immediate favour with the theatre-going and record-buying public, and its jerky, broken-glass catchiness was to insinuate itself into two or three generations of music theatre composers' work, from Mark Blitzstein's controversial 1937 musical The Cradle Will Rock to his friend Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story, 1957, thence to Sondheim's Sweeney Todd, 1979, Kander and Ebb's Flora the Red Menace, 1965, and Cabaret, 1966, and even, dare I venture, my own 1984 collaboration with Melvin Bragg, The Hired Man. Weyl and Brecht's theatre songs further cast their spell on later artists as diverse as Frank Sinatra, Louis Armstrong, Bob Dylan, David Bowie, Sting, Lou Reed, Marianne Faithfull, Tom Waits, Dagmar Krause, and Martha and Rufus Wainwright, all of whom produced cover versions. What binds these cover versions, except for the unrhythmical braggadocio of Sinatra, imitated more recently by Robbie Williams, and the loose, growling swing style of Satchmo, is a quality of acerbic detachment, a serrated edge that could strip one's emotional defences, or wallpaper. The Threepenny Opera ends with Mac the Knife, a low-life criminal absolutely devoid of morality and remorse, about to be hanged, when Queen Victoria instead grants him a pardon, a title, a castle, and a pension. The absurdity of this reversal of fortune may not have struck millions in the industrialised world after the Wall Street crash of 1929 as all that implausible. Life had become unpredictable and harsh. As the world descended into anxiety, paranoia and financial meltdown, not to mention fascism and Stalinism, increasingly it was composers embracing popular forms who became the voice of conscience. This subterranean shift could not have been anticipated at the start of the century, nor were the fruits of the voice of conscience without controversy and complication, particularly where questions of race came into play. Take the 1935 American folk opera Porgy and Bess by George Gershwin, with lyrics by his brother Ira and playwright DuBose Heywood. Set in a poverty and drug-stricken African-American fishing community in the South, Porgy and Bess was notable for its sympathetic but clear-eyed portrayal of underclass life. The fact that three white men wrote Porgy and Bess caused unease at the time and has stirred a certain amount of discomfort ever since. That the characters in the opera, which was based on an earlier play by DuBose and Dorothy Heywood, may be unflattering racial stereotypes that ghettoise African Americans, is a legitimate subject for debate, even if Porgy and Bess has paradoxically only attracted this criticism because it has, on account of its great quality, outlived the many other artistic portrayals of earlier, less enlightened times. Its genius and consequent longevity have in effect caused it to be penalised, whereas a once popular parlour song like Ernest Hogan's All Coons Look Alike to Me, A Darkie Misunderstanding, 1896, has rightly been forgotten by most. Porgy and Bess suffers from much the same problem as Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice or Wagner's Parsifal, both of which arouse discussion of perceived anti-Semitism because they are both still performed today. Whether it's fair to charge the Gershwin brothers simply because they were white Jews writing about African Americans per se is a much less clear-cut accusation. What has never been contested is the beauty and timeless power of the songs the Gershwins created for Porgy and Bess, and which have been covered uncomplainingly by most of the great African-American recording artists of the 20th century, including Louis Armstrong, Ella Fitzgerald, Oscar Peterson, Miles Davis, and Aretha Franklin. In tackling the inequalities and injustices of the Great Depression, popular song of the 1930s proved it was already light years ahead of All Coons Look Alike to Me, even if groundbreaking songs that provoked serious thought were still rare. In the frothy 1930 Broadway review The New Yorkers, Cole Porter made his well-to-do audience sit uneasily through a sympathetic portrayal of a prostitute in the piercingly sultry song Love for Sale, though initial resistance by censors was relaxed when the character was changed from white to black. Race relations were still lagging shamefully behind gender politics. Even relatively liberal-minded Porter, though, could not match the devastating impact of the Abel Mirapol song Strange Fruit, recorded by Billie Holiday in 1939. The song, which began as a poem, is thought to have been prompted by the shocking and sadly iconic newspaper photograph by Lawrence Beitler of the lynching of Thomas Shipp and Abram Smith in Marion, Indiana, in August 1930. Despite the undoubted inspiration it provided for the leaders of the subsequent civil rights movement in the United States, the birth of Strange Fruit was by no means easy. Holiday's usual record company, Columbia, refused to release it, and a small independent label had to take it on instead. Radio stations likewise gave it a wide berth. Some concert venues objected so much to this signature song being included in Holiday's set that white staff would deliberately create noise with the cash tills or bottle crates while she was singing it. 2 years after the recording of Strange Fruit, Mirapol was summoned to appear before New York State's Rap Kudat Committee investigating alleged communist infiltration of the state's high schools. He was accused of having been commissioned by the Communist Party to write the song. That it became well known against such odds is testament both to its simple power and to the fact that it was still extremely difficult in 1939 to challenge publicly the inequality of the race divide in America. Holiday's performance and the disturbing images of the poetic text mark the moment in the development of popular song when it could no longer be dismissed as mere frivolity. In the troubled 1930s, escapism and harmless entertainment were the principal domain of popular music, but, as Chaplin's Modern Times and The Great Dictator showed, being commercially successful was no longer synonymous with a lack of serious purpose. That the Nazis should have felt threatened enough by American jazz and swing to ban it in the Third Reich, despite or perhaps because of its popularity among the German population, is a telltale indication of its potential to unlock the dangerously unpredictable emotions of whole populations. To the Nazis, American jazz was racially inappropriate, i.e. African, and decadent, though hypocritically they continued to encourage German recording artists to cover favourite swing numbers for the enjoyment of their master race citizens. Escapist fun was not, by and large, a route chosen by classical composers in the 20th century. The final gasp of classical music's contribution to uncomplicated fun was probably Franz Lehár's The Merry Widow, which opened in Vienna in December 1905, and Ermanno Wolf Ferrari's comic romp I Quattro Rusteghi, The School for Fathers, which opened in Munich in March 1906, though Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, opened January 1911, might just squeeze into the category. After that, seriousness, confrontation and challenge were classical music's guiding stars. Indeed, when Shostakovich wanted to mock German culture in his Seventh Symphony to evoke the Nazi invasion of the USSR, which we'll come to shortly, his parody march was based on a tune from Lehár's The Merry Widow. Even today, there is no greater venom among hardcore classical music champions than that reserved for so-called crossover artists who dare to pollute the pure waters of the classical repertoire by appealing to the masses. For Lear and Wolf Ferrari in the early 20th century read Il Divo and André Rieu in the 21st. As European nation-states descended into industrial-scale barbarism in the second half of the 1930s, musicians in these countries were placed in a difficult position. Jewish artists and intellectuals of all kinds fled Nazism, and music by Jews, communists and blacks was banned in the Third Reich and its occupied territories. A touring exhibition called Entartete Musik, Degenerate Music, opened in 1938, ridiculing these minority composers, as well as non-Jewish French composers Ravel, Satie and Saint-Saëns, who were deemed for the purposes of the exhibition to be Jewish. What, though, were the non-Jewish composers left behind expected to do? Collaborate or resist? Composers who remained in Germany and wanted to have their music performed had no option but to stay on the right side of the regime. Orchestras and opera houses thrived under the Nazis, supported by generous state funding. Musicians and singers were granted privileges and perks denied the rest of the population in wartime. Indeed, the only adult males in the whole of Berlin's population exempt from defensive duties during its apocalyptic fall to the Red Army in April-May 1945 were the members of the Berlin Philharmonic. In the first hours after the guns fell silent in the ruined city, one of the most horrifying sights reported by civilians and Russian soldiers emerging from the rubble were the corpses of young boys hanging from lampposts in the city centre, with signs round their necks reading "coward" or "would not fight for his fatherland." Yet, as reported in Misha Aster's eye-opening The Reich's Orchestra, the Berlin Philharmonic, 1933-1945, within days of the city's surrender, the players of the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra were congratulating themselves on being able to convene a rehearsal in a makeshift hall and to keep the flame of their reputation alive in spite of the devastation all around them. The Nazis accorded music considerable esteem, hoping to shape the course of musical history by manipulative policies affecting the production and reception of music across the vast territories they eventually controlled. Attempting to eradicate Jewish composers and musicians under their jurisdiction was one way of stifling a particularly vigorous community of practitioners in the field, filling the inevitable gaps in Germany's numerous pre-1933 musical institutions with Aryans whose abilities were less important than their racial background. It can only be guessed what future musical riches may have been forfeited from the loss of talent to the Third Reich's programme of extermination. Despite wrapping up their objections to aspects of musical modernism in pseudo-scientific claptrap about degeneracy, the Nazi leaders' distrust of certain forms of music was nothing more than crude beer-cellar racism. Thus, atonal, 12-tone or serialist music, was condemned when it was by Schoenberg, its Jewish inventor, but condoned when it was by the Aryan Paul von Klenau. The most famous living composer in Europe, the now elderly Richard Strauss, had a relationship with the Nazi government that oscillated between polite acquiescence and obstinate standoffishness, despite its PR-conscious enthusiasm to keep such a high-profile cultural figure happy. He didn't openly take the regime to task for its abhorrent racial policies and was involved in a number of prestigious propagandist events. He composed a hymn for the 1936 Berlin Olympics and conducted his festive prelude at the 1938 Reich Music Festival convened by Joseph Goebbels, at which the grotesque Entartete Musik exhibition was launched, but mostly Strauss withdrew from public life. Strauss scholars disagree on whether his withdrawal was a rejection of his previous accommodation with the regime, a suspicion that it might not last, or simply an old man choosing retirement. One composer who had no qualms about cooperating with the Nazi regime was Karl Orff, whose Carmina Burana had its tumultuously successful premiere in Frankfurt in June 1937. Its sequel, Catulli Carmina, the second part of a trilogy, was presented at the Leipzig Municipal Theatre in November 1943. It is surely the only work in the choral repertoire with a repeated chorus of mentula, 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 penis, 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 penis. Orff had his tetchy criticisms of the regime, not directed at its deranged policies, mind, but because it wouldn't roll out his children's music programme, Schulwerk, into all state schools in the Reich. He did, however, accept the Nazi government's commission to replace the Jewish Mendelssohn's incidental music to Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, and felt unable to intervene on behalf of a close friend, Kurt Huber, founder of the White Rose Resistance Group, who was tortured and executed by the regime. After the war, Orff claimed falsely at his denazification tribunal that he had himself been involved in the founding of the White Rose movement. All in all, and certainly from a musical point of view, Orff's acquiescence with the Third Reich drove him into a cul-de-sac from which he never really recovered, which is unfortunate, if only because Carmina Burana was one of the handful of new classical works written between 1930 and 1960 that found genuine popularity with the general public without seeking to be deliberately old-fashioned. Ottorino Respighi's patriotic paeans to Roman power in fascist Italy, Pines of Rome and Roman Festivals of 1924 and 1928 were also newly written and popular, then as now, but they sit squarely amid his reliquary of plundered, reorchestrated musical trinketry of Italy's distant past. The nearest thing classical music had to a genuine political dissident in the 1930s was the Hungarian modernist Béla Bartók. By the 1930s, Bartók was eminent as a cutting-edge modernist composer in the Stravinsky mould. His Music for Strings, Percussion and Celeste, 1936, and Sonata for Two Pianos and Percussion, 1937, had already established his reputation throughout Europe and are still regularly performed today. He was also a tireless collector and annotator of East European folk song, and is in fact one of the chief architects of a whole branch of music study known as ethnomusicology. Bartók had serious misgivings about Hungary's slide towards fascism, concurrent with developments in Germany and Italy, and after the Nazis seized power in Germany, he forbade all performances or broadcasts of his music in the Third Reich and fascist Italy, a gesture that impoverished him, since his publishers and the lion's share of his royalties came from Germany. When, in 1938, Goebbels mounted his Entartete Musik exhibition, Bartók asked for his name to be added to the list voluntarily, so disgusted was he with the hate campaign waged against selected modernist music, jazz, and anything composed or performed by Jews, Slavs, Romani people, or anyone of African origin. Like most high-profile classical composers, though, Bartók was able to leave Axis-controlled Europe safely. He resettled in the United States in 1940, thereby avoiding any more serious consequences of challenging the totalitarian line. However difficult the situation in Hungary, however, it was a tea party compared to the nightmare that unfolded in Russia in the 1930s. From 1934 onwards, Stalin rigorously suppressed any sign of decadence, code word for avant-garde, from composers, in line with his general cultural clampdown, a significant U-turn on the previous Soviet policy of encouraging experimentation in the arts. This hardening of official attitudes made life increasingly difficult for Russia's leading composers, Prokofiev and Shostakovich, Stravinsky having emigrated, only to return for one emotional visit in 1962, aged 80. At times they were in favour and received privileges ordinary Russians would have marvelled at. At others, their continued survival as professional composers hung by a thread. Shostakovich, for example, was officially denounced in 1936 and again in 1948, but was also a multiple recipient of state Stalin prizes for the arts, a People's Artist of the USSR, and holder of the Order of Lenin, the Order of the October Revolution, and Hero of Socialist Labour. He and Prokofiev were both mercifully spared the treatment accorded writer Alexander Solzhenitsyn, whose criticisms of Soviet authority in his books and public statements landed him in a Siberian prison camp. Analysts since their time have discussed at length whether Shostakovich's and Prokofiev's music somehow defied Stalinism in some surreptitious, ironical or coded manner, even when it was ostensibly towing the party line, which variously entail being optimistic and relevant to the ordinary people, abiding by socialist-realist principles in Soviet jargon, not being too Western-sounding, reactionary, and not being too modernist, formalist. Strangely, it was one of Shostakovich's most instantly admired larger-scale works, and one which was set in the bad old days of Tsarist Russia, that started his problems with the Soviet regime. His opera Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk district, which opened at the Mari Theatre in what was then Leningrad in January 1934. Lady Macbeth of the Mtsensk district isn't exactly HMS Pinafore. It's a hard-hitting, sometimes grotesque, often violent and erotic spectacular. It's exciting and powerful, but you couldn't call it tuneful or a laugh a minute. Although the story, which concerns a faithless wife who murders her husband, ends up in a Siberian labour camp with her lover, then kills herself, was set in the days of the hated former regime, it must have been crystal clear to its audiences that not much had changed. Indeed, when Stalin, Molotov and a coven of other party leaders went to the Bolshoi Theatre to see it in December 1935, the same thought occurred to them. They walked out in disgust. A few days later, the official newspaper of the party, Pravda, published a stinging attack, thought at the time to have been written by Stalin himself, on Lady Macbeth and its composer, headlined "Chaos Instead of Music." It described the music as fidgety, screaming and neurotic, and as a confused stream of sound. The story was caricatured as coarse, primitive and vulgar. Another venomous article appeared the following week. Shostakovich was denounced by the Soviet Composers' Union, and then came a deluge of public criticism, even from former friends and colleagues. A few months later, he was summoned to the Big House, the headquarters of the NKVD, the forerunner of the KGB. Many walked through its doors over the course of the 1930s, not many walked out again. To put this terror in context, between January 1935 and June 1941, official figures claim arrests by the NKVD of just under 20 million people, of which an estimated 7 million were executed. The secret police wanted Shostakovich to answer questions about his friendship with Marshal Tukhachevsky, former head of the Red Army who was being set up for a show trial. He was interrogated on a Friday and told to return on the Monday. In anticipation of his own arrest and almost certain death in the gulag, Shostakovich packed his bags, but in a bizarre twist that was strangely typical of Stalin's looking-glass world, he was saved by the fact that the NKVD official himself had been purged over the weekend. Clearly, whatever Shostakovich did next was going to seal his fate one way or another. He shelved his newly completed Fourth Symphony, sensing that its dark modernity might make matters worse, and for a while retreated to the relative safety of film scoring. The work that eventually emerged from all this anguish, his Fifth Symphony, premiered in November 1937, is now recognised as one of the classical masterpieces of the 20th century. Shostakovich edged back from his previous gloom and dissonance, composing a more traditional-style symphony of four contrasting movements, progressing in them from grim, layered anxiety in the first to a triumphant conclusion in the fourth. The symphony's first audiences were unanimous in their loud approval of it, with extraordinarily emotional scenes at each performance. To the concert-going public, hanging on desperately to some kind of sanity in the midst of Stalin's murderous, arbitrary repression, the symphony offered a glimmer of hope and, interpreting the music's journey from struggle to resolution, some kind of defiance. Written in the teeth of the terror, it is an astounding testament of its time. It also, miraculously and without doubt, saved his life. The party endorsed it. It's easy, from the comfort and distance of our own time, to judge high-profile Soviet-era composers like Shostakovich and Prokofiev for not being more outspoken against Stalin, but they knew well enough what resistance meant in a time of purges. Leaving the USSR between 1936 and the end of the Second World War, in the way Bartok was able to leave Hungary, or film music pioneers Erich Korngold and Franz Waxman were able to escape the Third Reich, was all but impossible. Whether it is indeed possible to detect a challenge to authority in any abstract piece of music without being given prior non-musical information is debatable, and both party officials and early audiences of the Fifth Symphony would have been well aware of Shostakovich's own public description of his forthcoming work as a Soviet artist's creative response to justified criticism. Of course, this didn't stop contemporary commentators, nor modern ones, from imputing quasi-narratives to Shostakovich's Fifth, as had been the case with Beethoven's Eroica and Mahler's Fifth, a clear model for Shostakovich's Fifth, and hundreds of other pieces whose only descriptive clues lie in their directed performance speeds. Thus, one contemporary composer and critic, Boris Asafiev, claimed, "This unsettled, sensitive, evocative music which inspires such gigantic conflict comes across as a true account of the problems facing modern man, not one individual or several, but mankind." Shostakovich himself fueled speculation as to the meaning of his Fifth Symphony by saying cryptically, in later, safer years, "I'll never believe that a man who understood nothing could feel the Fifth Symphony. Of course they understood. They understood what was happening around them, and they understood what the Fifth was about." That a debate still continues, 75 years later, as to whether the triumph at the end of the final movement is a genuine triumph or a parody of triumph, reveals how tricky analysing abstract music and making assumptions about it can be. Whatever agonies Shostakovich and Prokofiev may have endured during the Stalinist terror, and however these agonies may have played themselves out in their music, what can't be denied is the two composers' solidarity for and love of Russia and its people, whoever was in charge. So when Germany invaded the Soviet Union in 1941, the agendas of Stalin and his composers were abruptly realigned. Composers' purpose and cause became patriotism. Perhaps the most extreme example of a large-scale work of patriotic purpose was Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony, Leningrad, premiered in March 1942 and dedicated to the people of his home city, who were at that time enduring an apocalyptic siege by the German army Group North and their Finnish allies. Shostakovich had composed some of the symphony in Leningrad itself, modern-day St. Petersburg, before his evacuation on official orders. It began life as a single, long, exhaustingly forceful movement, but Shostakovich, in a white heat of besieged inspiration, fleshed it out to a further three movements. Although the threat of official denouncement and censure was safely in the past, or so Shostakovich innocently thought, Leningrad nevertheless took the accessible, martial masculinity of the final movement of his Fifth Symphony as its stylistic starting point. Again, Mahler is all present in the first and subsequent movements, but this time there's no doubt whatever as to the sincerity of the triumph with which the finale concludes. In more recent years, a reluctant consensus has emerged among musicians that Leningrad may not be Shostakovich's best symphony, despite its iconic status. But its third movement, Adagio, is its highlight from a purely musical point of view, bringing together influences as diverse as Stravinsky and Bach in a lament that switches between unsettling block woodwind chords and wrought isolated violins. This symphony too, in the understandably heightened temperature of war, was scrutinised for meaning to within an inch of its life, Time magazine's preview for the US premiere summarising the first movement thus. The deceptively simple opening melody, suggestive of peace, work, hope, is interrupted by the theme of war, senseless, implacable and brutal. For this martial theme, Shostakovich resorts to a musical trick. The violins, tapping the backs of their bows, introduce a tune that might have come from a puppet show. This tiny drumming, at first almost inaudible, mounts and swells, is repeated 12 times in a continuous 12-minute crescendo. The theme is not developed, but simply grows in volume like Ravel's Bolero. It is succeeded by a slow melodic passage that suggests a chant for the war's dead. Whatever its meaning, its musical flaws or merits, Leningrad certainly succeeded in its patriotic purpose. In June 1942, a few weeks after its premiere, A score of Shostakovich's symphony was dropped overnight by plane into the city of Kubishev, present-day Samara, well behind Russian lines, and hastily assembled into orchestral parts. In Leningrad itself, in early August, a scratch orchestra of any musician still alive was put together for a performance that was relayed on PA systems throughout the city and out towards the German lines, which had been bombarded comprehensively beforehand to ensure some respite. The gesture of defiance and survival that the broadcast sought to express reverberated around the world. There can be no performance of a piece of music that has had so powerfully symbolic an impact as on that night in August 1942 in Leningrad. The symphony was performed repeatedly in Allied countries in the months that followed. The siege of Leningrad didn't end until January 1944, almost 2 years after the premiere of the symphony dedicated to it. It remains to this day the most deadly battle in human history in terms of lives lost. Over 1 million civilians and 1 million Red Army soldiers, with a further 2.5 million wounded. So desperate were conditions in the besieged city that, in the winter of 1941-2, police had to form a special unit to combat gangs involved in cannibalism. These were appalling scenes, compounded in January 1944 by the retreating German armies looting and destroying the historic galleries, mansions and palaces of the Tsars. A huge haul of art treasure was taken back to Nazi Germany, but there was one cultural item that could never be stolen from Leningrad, Shostakovich's Seventh Symphony. In Britain, some classical composers joined the war effort by composing scores for patriotic films, such as William Walton's stirring accompaniment for Laurence Olivier's Henry V. But it's fair to say that the orchestral music that most bucked up ordinary people on the home front was Eric Coates's Calling All Workers, the theme tune of BBC Radio's Music While You Work. Benjamin Britten enjoyed an extended holiday in America, while Michael Tippett, a conscientious objector, produced an eloquent and moving wartime plea for unfashionable pacifism in his oratorio A Child of Our Time. A Child of Our Time reflects upon real events from 1938, the assassination of German diplomat Ernst von Rath by a 17-year-old Jewish refugee, Herschel Greenspan, enraged at the deportation of his family and 12,000 other German Jews. The assassination led to the Kristallnacht pogroms across Germany and Austria. A Child of Our Time intersperses quasi-operatic narrative passages with arrangements of African-American spirituals, as Bach had done with Lutheran hymn chorales in his oratorios on the Passion and Crucifixion of Jesus Christ. A Child of Our Time may be classical music's most heartfelt answer during the 1940s to the challenge of Billie Holiday's Strange Fruit to confront the anxieties of the age in a language that could still communicate to the community at large. For other mid-20th century composers, however, it seemed increasingly as if being complicated and uncompromising was more important than producing something beautiful, entertaining, or simply enjoyable. Few of the contemporaries of American composer Aaron Copland heeded his open-hearted declaration in his Appalachian Spring of 1944 that 'tis a gift to be simple. Like Stravinsky's Firebird, Rite of Spring and Les Noces, Debussy's Je, Prokofiev's Romeo and Juliet and Ravel's Daphnis et Chloé and Bolero, Copland's Pulitzer Prize-winning Appalachian Spring was composed as a ballet score. It's hard to imagine what 20th century classical music would have done without ballet. It was as if the distraction of telling a story, of reaching a different audience, or of submitting to the structure of another art form liberated composers from having to deal with the question, whither music? It was a question that ran like an unstable, life-threatening electrical current through the century that followed 1910, the year that had confidently yielded Stravinsky's Firebird, Elgar's Violin Concerto, Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier, Vaughan Williams's C Symphony, Ravel's Daphnis et Chloé, Parry's Fourth Symphony, Puccini's The Girl of the Golden West, Scriabin's Prometheus, The Poem of Fire, Debussy's First Book of Preludes, the premiere of Mahler's Eighth Symphony and the completion of his Ninth. Such confidence was inconceivable 30 years later. Audiences adored Copeland's Appalachian Spring, though, with its touching innocence and optimism, as if America's victory in the Second World War really would usher in a better age, all reflected in the sincerity and uncynical values of the pioneer rural communities it celebrates. The phrase, "'Tis a gift to be simple," comes from the Shaker spiritual song, Simple Gifts, the melody of which, composed by Joseph Brackett, a member of the Shaker community at Gorham, Maine, is widely quoted in the ballet score. It's worth noting, though, that Aaron Copland, left-wing, gay and Jewish, might have approached the same commission very differently had it come his way after the liberation of the Nazi death camps, or Hiroshima, or during the McCarthyist witch hunts. Unlike much else composed in the 1940s, it is still popular and regularly performed both in the theatre and on the concert stage today. Nevertheless, the concert hall success of Copland's Appalachian Spring, as with Tippett's A Child of Our Time, Shostakovich's symphonies, Stravinsky's ballets and Orff's lusty secular oratorios, should be seen as the high end of public engagement with the arts, belonging to a classical tradition that, by and large, maintained a separate, parallel path from any of the key popular genres. You don't expect to hear rock and roll guitar in Shostakovich or a bluesy sax solo in Bartok, even though these composers would have heard both often during their working lives. But ballet was not the only medium that allowed classical composers to hang on to their distinctive orchestral idiom and appeal directly to a broad audience, freeing them from writing overcomplicated, abstract music that a listener might need a PhD to appreciate. Dance certainly had a huge influence on music in the 20th century, but classical music would surely have continued sleepwalking on the path to oblivion after the war had it not been for another knight in shining, or perhaps silver, armour, cinema. Following Alexander Nevsky, Prokofiev's groundbreaking collaboration with fellow Russian filmmaker Sergei Eisenstein in 1938, it was clear that large-scale orchestral music was going to be a powerful component in making films more exciting, more frightening, and more emotional. To this day, millions of people who might never set foot in a classical concert hall thrill to the symphonic sound of film scores that are often made up entirely of classical orchestral styles and techniques. If anyone tells you classical music is dead in the 21st century, all it means is that they don't go to the cinema. When European composers fled Nazism in the 1930s, they usually ended up in Hollywood, hoping to make a living from film, an opportunity the directors, producers and writers, who were themselves either émigrés or the children of émigrés, were happy to provide. Some, like Erich Korngold, leapt enthusiastically into this new, populist role with skill and seriousness, widening the scope and capability of the film orchestra in the process. His scores for Captain Blood, The Seahawk, and The Adventures of Robin Hood only seem like clichés to us now because their swashbuckling grandeur has been so comprehensively imitated for so long by so many others. The truth is, though, that from the 1940s until the 1990s, film composers tended to be a different breed from concert hall composers. Few classical composers made headway in film, and many viewed it suspiciously or with condescension as something only good enough for the paying of bills. How shallow that criticism now seems, with some of the best purely orchestral music from the past half century being written for film. Whether the thrilling, scary power of Bernard Herrmann's Vertigo and Psycho, or Miklos Rocha's Spellbound, the haunting melancholy of Ennio Morricone's The Mission, Nino Rota's Godfather, or Gabriel Yared's The English Patient, the expansive drama of John Barry's Goldfinger, Morris Jarre's Lawrence of Arabia, the sweeping adventure of Dmitri Tiomkin's High Noon, or Danny Elfman's Batman, the sensuality of Jerry Goldsmith's Chinatown, or Thomas Newman's American Beauty, or the heartbreaking grace of Dario Marianelli's Atonement and John Williams's Schindler's List. What's remarkable about this tiny tip of an iceberg roll call of great scores is that, as I write them down, I know that many of you will be able to instantly recall the mood and themes of these scores in your minds. They are part of a shared cultural inheritance of the past half century. Of how many other classical works since the Second World War is it possible to make that statement? For all the scepticism of film music among serious composers, cinema was a lifesaver for classical music. It not only gave the genre a new relevance in the modern age, but also brought it into the lives of people who would never have thought themselves interested in it. And indeed, introducing classical music to the masses became something of a mission for post-war governments. The governments of Third Reich Germany, fascist Italy, Roosevelt's America, Stalin's USSR, and Blitzkrieg Britain had viewed classical music not, like comedy, film, and popular music, as a comfort and distraction in grim times, but rather as a way of defining cultural identity among their populations, of saying, this is what we might lose if the barbaric enemy wins. After the war, they all determined to bring high art, as it was deemed to be, to the people, setting up various publicly funded and privately sponsored institutions to make this a reality. The great American conductor and champion of new music, Serge Koussevitzky, for example, commissioned Benjamin Britten's gloomily magnificent opera Peter Grimes, which, miraculously, was produced at Sadler's Wells Theatre in a bombed-out London just 4 weeks after VE Day. Despite the cast of Peter Grimes's first production complaining that the music was difficult, modernist and impenetrable, it presented no such obstacle to opera-goers in the UK and around the world, both at the time and in the decades to follow. This, surely, was because what Britten had written was essentially an old-fashioned 19th-century music drama such as Verdi, or even at a pinch Wagner in Flying Dutchman mode, might have concocted, which brings us to one of the perhaps unexpected trends that emerged from the post-war promotion of music. Undeniably, the instinct to support the arts went, and still goes, hand in hand with the desire to reach out to larger numbers of people, but the two aims were often contradictory. Orchestras and opera houses, for instance, tended to be presided over by powerful patrons who might well have paid lip service to the notion of introducing ordinary folk to the new and unfamiliar, but who were just as concerned with getting the state to subsidise an expensive minority taste. The fact that the new was narrowly defined as contemporary classical rather than, say, bebop, is indicative of this. Public subsidy allowed formats that had become financially unviable, such as the 19th century symphony orchestra, to prosper somewhat artificially in the 20th century, justified by the preservation of heritage. In previous centuries, forms had come and gone as the market, or aristocratic fashion, changed. Nobody, after all, had tried to keep Louis XIV's lavish opera ballet spectacles going after he died of gangrene. But what subsidy and philanthropic patronage of classical music in the post-war years made possible were two somewhat paradoxical outcomes. The preservation of a musical idiom that was obstinately fixed in the mentality of the 19th century opera house and concert hall, and the blossoming, as we shall see shortly, of carefree, unedited experiment that was occasionally creative, often quite mad, and always mind-bogglingly self-indulgent. It would be a while before new classical music set the pace of change. Meanwhile, the war had brought about whirlwind developments in technology, some of which, such as the invention of magnetic tape for recording, would have a direct effect on music. Others, like high-speed cars, planes and rockets, found their giddy velocity reflected in music of revived, exhilarating energy. However threatened classical composers might have been by the inexorable rise of popular song in the jazz and swing era, it had been a light summer shower compared to the hurricane coming their way in the 1950s, and it was a hurricane with one unavoidable exhortation. Roll over, Beethoven. Chapter 8, The Popular Age 2, 1945 to 2012. The years 1939 to 45 will forever be remembered as a turbulent turning point in world history. But at the same time, thanks in large part to the unprecedented movement and displacement of populations during this period, to American military presence in Europe and the Pacific, and to the United States emerging from the conflict as the economic and cultural dynamo of the world, American musical styles established themselves as the focus of change and growth in the decades following the war. The war years signalled a watershed in music, as the swing variant of jazz gave birth to a new form, one that would sweep the planet like no other musical phenomenon before it, rock and roll. The genesis of rock and roll can be traced back to a swing recording made in 1939 by the Benny Goodman sextet, 7 Come 11. On the surface of it, 7 Come 11 fits the mould of the classic swing number, energetic, well-organised, with symmetrical phrases, a predictable, reassuring, chugging-along rhythm generated by brushes on the snare drum, and distinct moments set aside for Benny Goodman's crystal-clear clarinet solos. Then, out of this run-of-the-mill swing exuberance, something emerges that is new in its sound, new in its execution, and new in its improvisatory style. It's an electric guitar, an instrument invented in 1931, played by a 23-year-old African-American from Oklahoma, Charlie Christian, who co-wrote the song with Goodman. If you've never heard of him, now is the time to make up for the omission. His musical efflorescence was tragically brief, but this is the man who turned the chord-strumming, jobbing electric guitar into a high-wire, virtuoso lead instrument from Also Ran to Star Turn. If you were young in the 1940s, this Christian was your messiah. To our jaded 21st century ears, Charlie Christian's solo on 7 Come 11 may not seem all that earth-shattering, but to musicians of the 1940s it was a green light. Jazz musicians took from it a fast, free-flowing, unpredictable stream of consciousness in sound, inspired by Christian giving emphasis, accent, to beats that would not normally have been strong, and allowing the tune to stray like a river bursting its banks across open countryside, meandering across chords to which it was never intended to fit. Christian bends the strings as he solos, tweaking the notes above and below their standard tunings, not something one could notate very accurately, nor indeed would he have wanted to, as he attempted to give the guitar the cutting-edge energy of a tenor saxophone. This frantic, somersaulting style turned within a few years into bebop, the elite modern jazz of the late 1940s and 50s. In bebop, whole tracks were devoted to helter-skeltering instruments, sometimes solo, sometimes in coordinated groups, tumbling across notes at high speed, willfully oblivious of the harmonies to which they once belonged. If death-defying, off-piste skiing at high altitude down near vertical slopes had a musical equivalent, bebop would be it. Bebop took a basic song shape, with its chord sequence and the ghostly outline of its tune lurking somewhere in the background, and used this as the oft-repeated foundation for an improvised solo from each member of the band in turn. Before bebop, the solos bore some resemblance, at least as they began, to the song's original melody, and they also adhered to its key family and chordal logic. Bebop defied these conventions on several layers. Solos increasingly drifted away from the chord sequence and even the key family of the original song, and they habitually veered off from the given song melody too. Soon, bebop musicians began dispensing with the blueprints of the standard songs and instead invented their own chord sequences and melodies, highly complex ones at that, sometimes derived from the note combinations of unusual chords. Though the ethos of post-war jazz, with its celebration of freakishly talented individual skills, its infatuation with complicated chords, and its ambitiously long, stamina-testing pieces, was always closer to that of classical music than of happy-go-lucky pop, the actual sound of bebop was about as far from what was going on in 1950s classical music as it was possible to be. Classical music in the mid-20th century was most